It is awesome to have you here. We've been back and forth like a few times trying to find like a good time that works for both of us, and it kind of shows how manic the Bitcoin industry is and like how fast everything's moving. So firstly, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
And I'm going to tell you a little story here. I first heard about you by at our conference actually in Edinburgh. So Alex Mann brought you up, and he said the Dishoom co-founder was into Bitcoin, and I was like, wow, okay, I love Dishoom, I love Indian food, and it's like, and he's into Bitcoin. I was like, wow, okay, I need to meet this guy, and this is like a year and a half later, we're finally doing this. So yeah, I'm very, very happy to have you here.
No, glad to share the story. And I love that. They're both kind of connected in some ways. You'll see back when I tell you a little bit about them.
Yeah, let's start at the Schumann, work our way back, how you got to there. Because my first encounter with Dishoom was you do the takeaway, the deliveries of the breakfast and like naan, and it blew my mind. Like I was making naan bread and throwing bacon on this, and it was phenomenal, and I got to make it myself. So for anyone that doesn't know what Dishoom is, and for the international audience, could you explain what it is and how did you get to actually co-founding it?
Great, sure. So, Dishoom, glad to hear that you're such a fan, by the way. So, Dishoom pays homage to the Irani cafes of 20th century Bombay and to the food of Bombay. And I launched it with my co-founders in 2010. When I exited, that was at seven cafes in 2017, and there are 10 now. My co-founders who I founded the business with are still the guardians of the business and doing a stellar job. And so my journey was into this was it's a bit of a long story, but like I'll link back to it when I talk about Bitcoin and how that happened. So I grew up in Kenya. I was Indian origin, and I moved to London when I was came up here for university. And a little bit more about my background, sort of when I came here. My mum was an exceptional cook. We actually owned a restaurant in Kenya when I was in my early teens. It was a very popular young teen then, bring takeaway food from the restaurant, I have to say. And so I grew up with a, let's say a decent palate, knowing what's good and what's bad, and actually, really, really loving my mum's food. And simple answer was I was homesick in the UK, and in the first 3 weeks I got taken to a curry house, and I kid you not, my honest impression was like, what the F is this? Like, this is not what I know of. This is not what my mom used to feed me. Slowly I kind of found my way to some of the suburbs where the Indian diaspora were and where the food I recognized as good was. But like my observation was, it was just not accessible, and it confused me a bit. But I didn't act on that thought. I wasn't like, okay, I've got an idea, I'm gonna launch something to solve for this. I actually studied economics, and I went into finance, and then only after a few years, when I realized that's not for me, and I quit. I wanted to start my own business, and my first business was actually a sandwich business. I grew it to a multi-site operation. We had about 32 sites, so I guess very well versed in how to run a food business in a very efficient way at scale. But it wasn't my brand, and I think that for me was a realization as an early entrepreneur that I wanted to do something on my own. And I guess like any industry, when you're then immersed in it, you know, the ideas that are maybe familiar to you start amplifying themselves. And the context also was, this was about 2005, 2006. And in the UK, the restaurant space was really starting to innovate, and it was quite exciting. Alan Yao, for example, had launched Wagamama, Usaba, Hakkasan, and you know, that was a context I had. And so I guess maybe the confidence to start to look at that as an idea, because I thought the curry house was such a tired stereotype, was my journey into why, you know, I was very interested to explore that. And it just so happened, you know, perfect storm, the co-founders that we knew, who were family and friends, you know, shared the same vision. And, you know, fast forward, Dishoom was then born after a lot of work, and you know what it is now.
Wow. It's such a good story. That what happened to the foods brand you had before Dishoom? Did you just, was that just because it wasn't aligned with what you wanted to do?
So it was when I said I didn't know, it was a franchise. And I, you know, it was relevant in the part, but I had exited out of that. You know, I chose not to be in that. But I had then since launched other retail businesses. I mean, I've unmapped right now. What I'm doing in Bitcoin mining is business number 6. So it's been quite a journey of businesses. Dishoom was number 3. And there've been a few after that. And so, yeah, I was out of that business. I had another retail business. And I think that from my perspective was allowed me to take the time to do that. But yeah, I've always had a number of interests and have been, I guess, evolving in myself to where I find myself today.
Yeah, very, very similar with that. And you can align your company with your passion and your values, then it feels a lot better, and it feels like you're not working.
Your values change a lot. Is like, if you find yourself with a business that, you know, doesn't quite align, what do you do about that? And maybe you'll answer a question when, you know, kind of why and how did I exit? I think it was mainly for that reason, that I wanted to sort of move to more where I thought the world was moving, and I wanted to participate a little bit more in that. And you know, here we are with Bitcoin and me kind of fully immersing into this world.
And what part did, so I was doing a little bit of research, and I saw something about the Singularity University.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I honestly, I hadn't heard of it before then. So I dived into it and I was like, wow, okay, this is a really cool concept.
Yeah.
Could you explain what it is and how that experience was?
So Singularity University, I mean, it's called a university, but I think it technically can't be called a university because its syllabus is constantly changing. I think you need to have a fixed syllabus for a few years for that designation. But I was at a conference through an organization that I'm part of, YPO. It's kind of very, you know, learning based and learning forward. And there's a speaker who came up, Peter Diamandis. Some people might have heard of the XPRIZE. You know, he's the founder of that and multiple other businesses. And he's also a founder of Singularity University. And he was there talking about exponential tech and how it's going to change the world, and how he's created, you know, championed this school to help leaders and thinkers to access it. And that really resonated with me because, you know, you know a little bit about my background. You know, I studied economics, I was in finance, and then I was, you know, in retail or food, and then restaurants. And so in my perspective, I'm almost like an outsider of tech, observing it from the outside, but very interested, understanding that it's very relevant and wanting to get more involved, or at least dig my teeth into it. And that's why I resonated with that. And so I went, they had a program, an executive program. And I mean, it blew my mind. It was phenomenal. For once, or for the first time, I could confidently frame a lot of these technologies and buzzwords that I'd heard of, understood them to a level of depth that was, you know, like good and it was accessible. And I could piece them together, like, you know, how they would converge, and that was scary but exciting at the same time. And that was actually the first time that I got presented with the idea of Bitcoin. This was in 2014. And the teachers were incredible. I mean, I got taught about Bitcoin and blockchains by Brock Pierce, who many of you will know is, you know, a real industry OG.
Mm-hmm. So what was the, what did it look like? Like, so you went to this university. Yeah. Not that, but so how long was it, and what were the courses like? Learn that then.
Yeah, so short, you know, intense executive program, a couple of weeks. It was held at I think it's called the Ames Space Center. It's kind of an ex-NASA site in Palo Alto. The teachers were, you know, Peter Diamandis himself, Ray Kurzweil, you know, talking about singularity, you know, his ex Google's chief head of innovation. We had Brock Pierce teaching us about Bitcoin and blockchain. I mean, you had some phenomenal teachers. You stayed on site. How many? We were a cohort of about 80 to 100 people out there. And really, yeah, it was just deep dive into all these verticals. So learned about robotics, you know, actually about AI and machine learning. Then, you know, Bitcoin and blockchain. It was fascinating for me. You know, thinking of myself as a complete outsider was fantastic. And I come out of this and I, you know, have a lot more confidence that, okay, I understand, you know, what's going on in terms of technological advancement. But what really I woke me up to was the rate of change of impact. And that's where I became very excited by it and realized that, you know, I wanted to spend more time focusing on this. And so the timing with that, as I simmered with that after a few years, then, you know, it's not coincidental that my exit out of Tshuma was in 2017. You know, that's all kind of linked to that whole path of exposure and learning.
Yeah. How, I love this aspect of it, because I'm seeing like a lot of founders aren't being able to keep up with the rate of change, because we are moving exponentially fast. And you have to now actively go out and learn like elements of AI, like how you can incorporate that into your business, and obviously Bitcoin and blockchain. How important do you think it is for founders now to be keeping on top of things rather than just sitting behind? And I like to use the, I don't know if you've read Michael Saylor's book, The Mobile Wave, and it's like, you need to jump. Yeah, I would really recommend anyone listening as well to read that. It's phenomenal because you can see why he talks about Bitcoin the way he does now, because he'd done that for the mobile and electronic devices in that book. And he pulls out the same things that he talks about. He just applies it to Bitcoin. Anyway, the moral of my story was, you need to jump on the wave and ride the wave rather than sitting behind it.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really, really great question. It is. So here's the way I think about it. So similar to my summary of what I gained out of Singularity University, this ability to frame, you know, how things may be. I mean, and by the way, just saying that, I feel a bit foolish because, like, it's impossible, like, to think about, you know, what things will be like accurately, because otherwise, if we could do that, I mean, we'd all be in different positions, right? I mean, but I think having some stake in the ground or some idea or thinking macro about where things are going, I think is very important to do, because otherwise I think you will get caught out. You know, if you don't think about how things are going to be or have some context of that, you may build a business or structure a business that, instead of catching the tailwinds of a technology that could help it in this way, will, you know, maybe get rudely and shocked or interrupted by a technology, you'll get disrupted. So I think that's one angle that I would say is really, really important that people pay attention to it, because you know, you could be putting in a lot of effort and actually executing on a business extremely well, but the business, unfortunately, it can be replaced or has a massive challenge faced by the advancements that we are to come and that we're facing. One other thing I guess to highlight is we are psychologically, we look back to give us a guide of how things will be looking forward. So, that linear thinking. And I think that's dangerous because, again, we can see, just recently how rapidly things are changing. And I think that exponential change needs to be appreciated as well. And I think that would be those would be the two points that I would make on this.
Do you think that an element of looking back is important as well? Just so from my perspective, the thing that brought me to Bitcoin, or really got me down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, was reading The Fourth Turning and The Sovereign Individual.
Yeah.
And both of those look back. But when you're talking there, I'm thinking to myself, they are just almost giving me a zoomed out approach and helping me sit back and analyze things. Do you think that's an element of that is still important?
Definitely. Yeah. So don't get me wrong. I think I was just talking about the rate of change. I think the expectation is, I can talk to my father. I'm so fascinated by, he was born in the late 40s and I can't just compute how much change the world is. He's seen the world, the change the world has gone through. And he would not have expected it because, life was slow. And so life has been slow. So it's the rate of change that I'm talking about. But absolutely. And, when we get to talk a little bit more about Bitcoin, I mean, understanding one example is understanding, where money came from is so important. You can't just have a view on Bitcoin if you don't understand money. I think it's important that you understand money so that you can contextualize Bitcoin. So absolutely, I think so important. Also, gave the example of the mobile revolution, which Saleh alluded to. Again, looking at past systems, cycles, trends, or very relevant, for adoption.
Yeah, it's common. You obviously have to know. I think a problem is that obviously people need to know about what money is and how it's evolved over time, but you need to show what the problem is before you give a solution. I think a lot of people think that Bitcoin is a solution looking for a problem, whereas it's actually the other way around. So that kind of that segues us into Bitcoin nicely. Yeah. So you said 2014, Bitcoin, that's when you first, was that the first time that you'd heard about it or the first time you'd started learning about it?
So I'd heard about it when I read Peter Diamandis' book, and he covers it. And I was curious. I didn't fully understand it, I think what Brock helped do is break it down really, really simply. And actually for me, if I'm honest, I hesitated a little bit around Bitcoin and why we needed a digital form of money. I hadn't put the two and two together, but also I think, I had a few years in finance and I got an insight into how ingrained our financial system is in the current way of things. But what was clear to me at the start was how impressive and necessary blockchain technology was for the world. And again, giving you a little bit of context of my past, when I grew up in Kenya, the exposure I had to some centralized systems, like, you know, voting systems and, you know, the elections, the general elections, which are completely compromised, you know, by central abuse, or the land registry, which was completely compromised with double title deeds. You know, those examples of transactional systems with, you know, non-fungibility, well, that's actually an idea that I had, is like, why don't we digitize the land registry, you know, at the time using a blockchain. And I was so excited by this that I, you know, I could see this as a trend that would continue. And actually, I think that makes me, I would say I'm a Bitcoin maxi, but I, you know, as in I'm drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, entirely now. But I'm also a believer that, you know, there are necessary and needed blockchain dApps that will help, you know, replace a lot of systems that we have.
Yeah. It's the thing is that we also don't know. I was reading, it was yesterday, I was rereading Jeff Booth's article, The Greatest Game, it's called.
Yeah.
And he was in that, it also says, like, we don't know what the future holds, essentially, is, but if we can build it on solid foundations, then who knows what's going to get built on top of it. Like, we're seeing layer twos, threes, so on. We don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I realize probably didn't answer the question fully as well. So let me just go back to then, you know, like, Bitcoin in the context that how it's influenced me and what my influences have been. So I feel like I'm referencing Kenya a lot, but, you know, I'm so grateful to have had the experience of growing up in the developing world. You know, Kenya, like much of the developing world, has most of its population unbanked. And what that means is, you know, you can't access real assets and you can't grow wealth. So that wealth inequality is, like, it's just, you know, it's stuck. I didn't really see a solution. But that problem, you know, still exists, and without existing monetary system, you know, is a problem that we face. Coupled with that, the experience that I, you know, saw firsthand was exchange controls. So you had local currencies which were depreciating annually, where you were, you know, limited from anything external to that you could hold. And again, that was a problem. It sought, you know, there were locals that were seeking safety in what were deemed the harder, safer fiat currencies that we know today. And then fast forward, you know, I go to university and, you know, I'm studying economics, and then I get exposed to the Western fiat, you know, monetary systems, you know, and over time realize that they're also complete dog shit. Yeah. And don't serve, like, you know, massively inflationary. And then this started to really fall into place, you know, around COVID 2020, when you see the huge, you know, money printing from the US, the UK, and the Western, you know, central banks. Mm-hmm. That for me was the tipping point, you know, where previously I was appreciative of Bitcoin. I knew it needed this network effect. For me, that was the time that I was like, okay, it's, if there's any point that's clearer, that a deflationary monetary solution, which is universal, is better than what we have currently, you know, showcased by what's going on.
Yeah,
that was the point.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of people would be able to relate to that as well, because I think that was a tipping point for a lot of people to expose how the fiat money system works. And actually go down and learn about it as well, kind of set you off on the path. Like, when you look at the M2 money supply of the US dollar, and you get to 2020 and it just goes vertical, makes a lot of people realize, oh wow, there's something wrong here. I don't know what's wrong. Is there a solution to that? But I love that. I want to ask you about the difference, like, between Kenya and the UK, that maybe the problem isn't as clear here, because we have a stronger fiat currency here that isn't devaluing at the same rate as other countries. Is there a big, what are you seeing the difference here? Because it's harder to educate those in the UK, I feel like, than...
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, look, I'll give you a few more anecdotes. Why, you know, when I came out of 2014, I genuinely felt like, you know, I was so excited, but the conversations I would have with some people would be like, you're just, you know, like, what are you talking about? You're almost like this, you seem like a, you know, a madman, or, you know, having these conversations, because the reality is, you know, in the last decade, we've had so much financial innovation on the existing system that it seemed that it was working extremely well. Like a lot of digital products, you know, money available digitally and being able to move digitally. So what's the problem? But yeah, that, I mean, that's the reality of, you know, developed economies, not necessarily the developing world. And a lot of them have, you know, accelerated. One key, and in Kenya, it's just, let's say, coincidental that, you know, this is the example I can give you versus, let's say, the UK, is M-Pesa was created in Kenya. And why it was so successful is because so many people are unbanked, and all of a sudden, you know, they never had connectivity and they have a phone. And then on, coupled with that, you know, not only are they connected, but they have a way to move money. You know, this was just a revolution in empowerment.
Yeah.
You know, but is that a way to create wealth? No, there's still challenges it faced. But you know, that it was a much easier conversation. I think because I had that background, I got it maybe a little bit more sort of easily than say people would appreciate. Because honestly, the conversations I had was, you know, there's nothing wrong with the system we have. It's fine.
Yeah. It's back to that whole building analogy of like building a house on sand, essentially, and it's just not solid foundation, but it can still appear to work perfectly fine. I can go to the shop and exchange value fine, but once you zoom out, it's like, okay, something's not right here. Connecting, before we move on to what you're doing now, connecting the whole entrepreneurial journey with Bitcoin, how important do you think it is for businesses to just be looking at Bitcoin now? And we've seen Michael Saylor holding it on the balance sheet. We see companies around, well, I can speak for companies around the UK and companies around the world now accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment. How important do you think that is for founders to be considering that, or business owners?
Yeah. Again, I go back to the point where I think you need to frame a view. If you are not understanding Bitcoin, understand it is the first thing. Because I think, you know, if you, let's say, make a list, let's break it down. Like, okay, back to your earlier question of, you know, you know, how to think about technology and you know, the impact of their business. But like, make a list of what are the sort of key technologies that you need to pay attention to. So I don't even want to call it crypto, call it blockchain and Bitcoin, okay? Or separate them if you need to. And then AI and, you know, robotics, drones, whatever. Like, make a whole list of those that are relevant to you. And understand them, because I think that's so important. And then when you understand them and you have a view, you know, that makes it easier for you to understand then, okay, should you make your business, available to be able to transact or to engage with other people, because this is where the world is moving, whether you believe it or not, you know, with Bitcoin, okay, then you can facilitate that. And if you have a strong view around it, then you've got another option around what you can hold on your balance sheet. I think so. You know, that liberation comes through awareness and empowerment, rather, of what you should do. But that's what I would urge, is just get your head around things and don't avoid it. Don't bury your head in the sand, because I think, you know, this is the world we live in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whether you want to understand it or want to like it or not, just you. I think you have to, because, you know, that's where we are. It's like you can't just you can't just operate in a space and just because you just, something seems complicated. I mean, just you avoid it. I mean, that's not a good approach in my view. I think just, you know, get your head around it and you'll, I always feel the more empowered you can be to make your own mind up rather than to be guided is a better position to be in.
100%. And not being, I'm writing a piece about status quo and trying to be uncomfortable. And you need to feel uncomfortable when you learn about these new things. I felt very uncomfortable learning about Bitcoin. Mm. And learning about AI, I still feel very uncomfortable. I don't know the subject well enough. But it is that whole going against the status quo and out of your comfort zone just for a little bit, just to see what's happening. I think it's really important for people to do these days because we're moving so fast.
I can agree more. I'll give you a personal share as well.
Please.
Firstly on Bitcoin, I think for me when I realized it, I was a little bit embarrassed because, you know, I was like, oh, I'm an economist, I should know this. Like, you know, I should know about the history of money. And I didn't ask these questions. Yet how could you call yourself an economist if you don't, like, you know, look back and fully understand it? And so I was a little bit embarrassed about that. But, you know, doesn't matter. Then you know, understood it and developed my own view. And like I said earlier, you know, I wasn't fully on there just only because I saw that the network effect was needed. But when it was there, I was happy to change my mind. But the personal share I want to give you is, and I mean, look, we've talked about this, Shroom. You know, I'm a big foodie. I always have been. I've been a big meat eater most of my life as well. And something that's close to me, which, and this is only to illustrate the point of to be curious and to open your eyes and to ask questions. And in my journey, you know, questions around kind of like, do I even fully know what's happening in the whole kind of animal farming side of things? And I didn't. And so to let you know that, like, you know, 5 years ago, after I exited Dishoom, I've since turned vegan because it's important to me, because what I've since opened my awareness to doesn't make sense to me. And so I've changed that. Just this is an example. This is not a kind of like, I don't want to come across as a kind of preaching that this is what people should be thinking about. But I think my message is, I think people should ask questions about the status quo, because the status quo is not always good. Us as humans have a tragic track record, of making bad decisions. But we also have a good track record of innovating out of them. And, you know, Bitcoin is a great example of, I think, an innovation to the monetary system, which also not a lot of people realize that it's not been here for, you know, the all of history. It's only been around for, you know, half a century, a little bit more than that, right?
Yeah, that's kind of where I start a lot of people off is 1971, what happened there. And because it has only just over half a century, you're right. We've actually been on this monetary system. Mm. And when you say that to someone, that gets them thinking. And they're like, oh, what was before that? And what was before that? Mm. But your point there, which I have also written about, is asking why. Mm. Why something is the way it is. That, I think, I feel anyway, that we're losing a little bit and we're not questioning stuff enough. And it is really important to question stuff and ask why the thing is the way it is. Mm. Do you think that... You also mentioned something, and I've written ego down. Do you think, it wasn't in reference to you, it just popped into my head about dropping your ego is hard to actually then go and learn something new and say, oh, maybe I was wrong here. Do you think that's a struggle for some people, and why maybe a barrier to Bitcoin?
Yeah. You know, what is ego and what is like the world? The world is like, if we're getting a little bit philosophical, it's just a fiction. Yeah. It's a fiction we create. Yeah. And I mean, if certain things are not in place, or if you just disappear, does everything stop? No, it doesn't. Yeah. Things get on and like new fictions are created. And so this, and by the way, you know, I think ego is necessary in a way, like to get us through life and like to have this ambition and mm-hmm. like a kind of a framing. I used the word framing earlier on, but it, you know, if we let it dominate us in a bad way, it, you know, it can be counterproductive, and it can fix us in a certain way of things that, no, this is who I am. This is what I believe in, you know, and it kind of like, it fixates you in this kind of definition. And I think that's unhealthy, because we don't know everything. Yeah. And I mean, if that's the way you want to operate, you just accept it. We wouldn't have evolved out of, you know, slavery and a lot of things that were just not right. And yeah, I don't know if that answers it, but like, yeah, it's clear that I think, you know, it's very, very healthy for us to be humble and be a little bit flexible, to have some ego there, but like have values and you know what's right and wrong, what's, you know, yes and no, and go with some curiosity and ask questions. Because if you don't, then, you know, I don't think that rigid attitude will serve anyone. And if the world thought like that, God, it would be just a selfish, self-destructive mess. And we evolve because, you know, thankfully there are a lot of people that ask these questions and are not afraid to. And I think that is great to have, and necessary really for humanity.
100%. Okay, we'll round off that section there, and let's move on to starting Unmapped. What got you there? What got you interested in the mining side of things, actually, is what I'm interested in, because there's so many different areas you could have come to Bitcoin with. Why the mining?
It's a good question. So simple answer to your question is I saw it as the best way to accumulate, you know, Bitcoin at wholesale levels than on the market. I think if you do that correctly at scale, you can do well. I've later realized that it's extremely difficult to get that formula right in the mining space. I really respect and admire, you know, miners that have survived lots of cycles and will continue to remain profitable. But we can discuss that. I'm a builder. I think, you know, the whole journey of kind of learning about myself from, you know, leaving that fund management job at Merrill Lynch to, you know, building an initial business right in the brand, you know, it's constant learning. And we talked a little bit about philosophy. I think if you ask me these questions, like, you know, when I started my career, I wouldn't give you the same answer. You know, I've kind of grown in that. But I know that I'm a builder, and I want to be involved in the architecture of Bitcoin. And to be honest, when I told you that tipping point I had, you know, during COVID, but then I asked myself, okay, well, again, the advice that I was giving, you know, other entrepreneurs, like understand things like better, like, you know, have an understanding. I didn't fully understand mining, like, you know, I hadn't gone down the deep rabbit hole, and I did, and I was like just blown away by also how I was very interested in the energy sort of systems that we have around the world, which, when you become a Bitcoin miner, you go down that rabbit hole, you can't ignore. You have to pay attention to them. And I find that we are, you know, it shocked me how clumsy our energy systems are for this day and age, with the technological advancement that we're just discussing right now, with such exponential change and explosion in capabilities. Our energy systems are almost like a caught off guard a little bit. And I think, you know, Bitcoin mining can be that catalyst, or I guess forcing a lot of that, you know, kind of those questions and the thinking around the energy system. So I'm finding it very interesting in this crossroads of, you know, solving for energy and mining Bitcoin at the moment. Mm-hmm. But it's tough.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I like to dabble in some mining stuff, and yeah, it blows my mind every time I do it because obviously being Scottish, there's a lot of stranded energy and excess energy in Scotland, and a lot of people come to me for to try and be that middle person to link people up. So there's a few projects up there, but I'm having to try and get my head around it as well because I'm super interested in the energy side of things because it's a problem. I'm seeing a problem there and I want to fix it. And I think that the Bitcoin mining is a solution to that.
And it could be a win-win as well. Like you've got access to secure and maybe a cost-effective energy rate that you can mine profitably at, versus where you think Bitcoin is or where it'll be. And my advice would be if you're going to do that, Bitcoin goes in cycles and Bitcoin mining is no different. Time it well, so it's like any trade, like how it's easier said than done. But if you are able to do that, then you can have these pockets of very profitable mining ventures and activities. But maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about some of the challenges that I'm seeing in the Bitcoin mining space and kind of where we're evolving to as a business. But I, where the halving's upcoming, we are seeing, mining at a much more difficult rate than it was, in previous times. And this is evident by the global hash price, which, while it's going, in cycles, I think there's, no doubt that it's trending down. And, give you an example. If you were mining, you could mine at home 6 years ago, at that rate and still be, profitable in a way. There's no way you could do that. There's no way you could do that on an industrial rate sometimes, so you have to be really, really, really efficient when you energy purchase and creative with that. There's a lot of consolidation. I mean, we didn't have a lot of listed miners, probably none, I think, at the last. No, we did. We had a handful, but like prior to that, there were, not really too many. And so the prominence and growth of large scale miners and the consolidation has really started. And so our view is in the Bitcoin mining space, if you're not consolidating, you are probably gonna suffer or, I mean, consolidate or die really. And that's why we've kind of been working on this project that we're excited to launch in March, called the Bitcoin Mining Hub. So bitcoinmininghub.com. And it's to do with a lot of the factors that I've discussed here. And so what Bitcoin Mining Hub is, it's an access point to help bring together the needs of small, medium-sized miners. It's inclusive to enjoy the economies of scale or to achieve the economies of scale that a lot of large-scale miners have. We'll be launching with the Bitcoin Mining Pulse Survey 2024, which will include pool data, data from Coinmetrics, public miner data, so you can see your rank, in a variety of measures versus peers in the industry to establish where you are in terms of profitability. And there'll be other useful tools in the interface, the results dashboard that you'll be able to access. So that's kind of like us launching with value for the industry. And in terms of this aggregation that I was talking about and kind of what we're solving for, we're launching a miner syndicate to start with as well, which will deliver a flat rate pool fee of 1.5%. And that is to again create value. I think a lot of miners are paying 2% plus. So we're sort of just fixing it below that and giving it a flat rate. So if you have, there's no minimum. If you have one miner, where you'd be paying a lot more, you get to join this benefit. I think trying to keep and helping keep Bitcoin mining decentralized is important. And the needs of small, medium-sized miners is what we're solving for. And on the roadmap, we'll have aggregated buying. What we've seen on our path of trying to acquire a pipeline of mining sites is that these can be syndicated. You know, so there are lots of interesting ways and ideas that we have to deliver to, you know, a community that resonates with this. So, yeah, we're excited to launch and, you know, hopefully it hits the mark and delivers value to the industry the way we hope.
Yeah. And it's, I love it because it's identifying, yeah, a problem and coming up with a solution for it. And that's how it should be. But was that always the direction of Unmapped, or just identified that this is a really, really important thing to be focusing down on?
Yeah, I think like any business, you know, we talked about ego and the ability to change. And, you know, while let's say our definition or at the start was Unmapped is a Bitcoin mining company that will, you know, utilize predominantly clean energy sources and mine Bitcoin, you know, yeah, that would be the ambition. But I think it's, you know, it's got its challenges and we are where we are in the industry. And, you know, I think at the start, you know, when we kicked off, network hash was at around 100. It's at, you know, over 500 now. You know, it's been a huge sort of change in the industry just over a couple of years in a bear market. And this is us feeling that, you know, pain, but also then responding to, okay, well, what does the industry need now and how can we help? And how do we want to be a part of this narrative to be relevant, but also to solve, you know, and deliver value to the ecosystem? And, you know, would we still mine that could be a separate sort of entity potentially, but I, you know, I'm more excited to address this collective need. I think there's probably a better financial opportunity for us as well there, you know, from a return. But yeah, it's more like, you know, unifying the needs of other miners who are in the same similar position to us, and, you know, benefit as a group.
Yeah, 100%. That's how it should be. And do you think it will, having something like this, do you think it will incentivize more smaller to medium miners to start operating?
I hope so. So look, here's my observation again, Locke. You know, I see mining access is not easy. It's not clear. You know, there's a lot of industry folk talking in industry language who've been in the industry for a long time. You know, they will sell, you know, access hosting rates if you want to be a retail miner at rates which I don't think are profitable long term. You know, like, you shouldn't mine at that level. It's not, you can go out on the market and buy Bitcoin at that. So I think there's a problem there with sort of that disconnect of access that you can trust and counterparties that you can trust. And, you know, we can solve for that by, you know, verification through an entity like this. So, you know, global hash rate's not fully represented. I think there's a lot of US centricity around things. You know, the user journey is so fragmented. I mean, I'm a little bit bemused that the most active channels to acquire, you know, ASICs and equipment are on Telegram. You know, I find that interesting. I mean, it is a niche. Yeah, I mean, well, that's your user journey, or, you know, direct relationships. It's quite archaic. Yeah. You know, there's not really a central hub, you know, right now for, you know, equipment, hosting, you know, and then emerging in pockets. Yeah. But, you know, that could be an opportunity down the roadmap. But like, let's solve for, like, you know, a clear value proposition right now, like value. Yeah. Like the minute you sign up, and you can sign up for our pool, you know, instantly. That's value there. And then, okay, when we go on consolidating our buying requirements, this can deliver the sorts of economies of scale to miners, which they're not achieving if they're buying small quantities. But another challenge is, like, you know, when you get around to, you know, wanting to sell your equipment, how do you do it? I mean, you're kind of stuck. So there are lots of things that we can do that are kind of, like, let's say, not working as well as they could be. But mm-hmm. I think one step at a time. But yeah, I mean, we have ambitions on, you know, a roadmap that we've painted out of you know, products and things we want to solve. But we'll do it in a sequenced way.
Amazing. I'm excited to see it. And you say it was launching next month in March?
Well, I say next month, but that means, like, you know, in a week or 10 days. I don't know when this will go live, but let's just say the first week of March is the target launch date. Yeah. We wanted to give a good window to the halving. So you'll be able to use the results dashboard and see your ranking with a survey if you participate in the survey. And that window will be open for a few weeks, after which we'll publish the results to the, openly after the halving event. So really encouraging people to, come on board and be a part of the hash rate that we're counting. We'll go live with about 120 exahashes of survey data and hopefully grow from there with the survey responses.
Amazing. Where can, for anyone that's listening, or where can they find out more about what you're doing before we wrap things up?
I really appreciate that. We're launching with the URL www.bitcoinmininghub.com. As simple as that. And you'll be able to find access to the Bitcoin Mining Pulse survey there and the pool on the same landing page as well.
Amazing. I'll put it in the description of wherever anyone is listening or watching. You've done well to get that domain as well. That's an awesome domain.
No, I appreciate that. It wasn't too bad actually. We were brainstorming some ideas and it was one of the ones that we landed on and it was available and it was like, okay, well, oh, wow. I'll have that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that is we'll wrap things up because we've just hit an hour for us. Is there anything you want to touch on before we conclude, or do you think we've covered?
I think we've done a great job. We've covered so much. We've told the story. We've told about Bitcoin. We've talked about a little bit about what we're doing. I love what you're doing and kind of your mission, which you shared with me earlier. I wish you luck. I'd love to have a follow up maybe. Once we have some results and insights that come out of this survey, it'll be really exciting.